Let me ask you a question.
Break it down.
Okay. Do you really think that you're good at your job?
I think that I'm passable.
You are not good at your job, man. Yeah. You are not good at your job.
This is what you
got to know that by now. How are you even still working right now?
Yeah. Nothing to say.
We tell the truth. You smell. And you stink at your job.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You said you haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to a Super Bowl Sunday edition of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, February 7th, 2016. I am the Solid Monster. Big game today between the Panthers and the Broncos. Going to make my annual Super Bowl prediction here. My prediction is Panthers by a field goal, 2017. So there you go. You heard it here first. Although I have to say, you know, everywhere I'm going, I was at the barbershop the other day, went out to eat, even at work, the office across the hall. Everybody's doing these Super Bowl boxes. I don't even know how any of that stuff works. Believe it or not, I've never participated in a Super Bowl pool. I don't know how the boxes work. It's all very confusing to me. So I don't have any money on the game. But if I did, it would be Panthers by a field goal, 2017. Audible is still offering their 30-day trial to members of the Sound Off. You can take advantage of it by using our custom URL, audibletrial.com/solomonster. You can browse over 180,000 different audiobook titles on their website. Lots of wrestling books up there. You got to sign up. So once you actually register an account, you can then cash in one free audiobook of your choosing. It could be anything they offer on the site. And even if you cancel the trial in those 30 days, and hopefully you won't, but if you do, you get to keep your audiobook free. You are getting something for free. So it's a win-win situation for everybody involved. You're supporting the podcast when you use our URL. So please do, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Sign up, check out the service, and get yourself a free book today. Also want to say thank you to everybody who has made a PayPal donation to the show this week. $10 or more will get your wrestling nickname. Want to say thank you. Of course, as always, there are some familiar names on this list. James Hollywood Henderson, Deadpool James Herrera, John Loose Cannon Lopez, who we all know is Brian Blade's favorite donator, the Australian Ass Kicker, Anthony Patty, the Swashbuckler, Stephen Rangel, Hot Stuff Hector Pena, Jet Setter John Peterson, Scorpion Scott Kina, The Chosen Son, Andre Smith, Mentally Unstable Matt Cotter, Tony the Tiger Boylan, Malicious Intent Michael Cuomo, Rodney Hot Rod Cologne, The Newport Nightmare, Adam Grendel, The Saudi Prince Abdulaziz Gandhi, The Empress Erica Mullen, and the Seattle Saint Marco Wallace. Thank you very, very much for your support of the show. I also want to thank everybody for making us a two-time winner for Show of the Year in the annual Wrestling Radio Awards. Second straight year, 2015 was our best year yet, and 2016, I would say, is off to a pretty badass start. So thank you very much for that. If you're wondering why this is episode 424 and not 423, it's because the Rob Van Dam interview that I conducted, which is up on YouTube right now, it's about 20 minutes long. Yes, it is not the best audio quality in the world. RVD had just wrapped up a signing. I think he was out in the lobby somewhere where he was. I wasn't in a position. I'm not going to turn around to Rob Van Dam and go, "Hey, you know what, Rob, this doesn't sound too good. Why don't you get your ass in a private room and then call me back?" Click. Like, no, I'm not going to do that. So I think all in all, it worked out pretty well, and it was a pretty informative interview. We talked about his WWE status, among other things, and of course, we talked about the weed. Naturally, how could I not ask him about that? So that's up on our YouTube channel. Check it out. Give it a share. Give it a like. But I pushed it out to the feed so everybody can hear it. It's on iTunes. It's on Stitcher. It's on all the normal services as episode 423. So that's why this is 424. Shout out to Omar on Facebook. He uploaded video of himself. This is so cool. Driving through the streets of Tripoli in Libya, listening to this podcast. How cool is that? See, stuff like that, it never gets old with me. So that's very cool. But I'll tell you what's not cool. Podbean is throttling us Every week, I think we've solved the mystery of why a lot of you guys are having problems downloading the show right after it goes up, or getting those temporarily unavailable messages in iTunes. They're throttling us. I'm supposed to have unlimited bandwidth as part of the plan that I pay for, but I guess we are at a point where I need to go to their business tier in order to get on what they call their priority network to support all the traffic. You know, which is a good problem to have, don't get me wrong, and I have no problem paying more than I'm paying now, but it's a pretty steep jump what they're asking for. So I am weighing how to handle that. I probably am going to end up upgrading with them. You know, I do like the service. I've been with them for a long time. It would be a gigantic pain in the ass for me to migrate everything over in the feed if they would even let me. Probably not. So that probably will be the end result anyway. But if you're still having issues this week, now you know why. I haven't made the upgrade yet. I probably will. It shouldn't be happening much longer, so just bear with me. There's a lot of upgrades I'm planning on making in the next few months, including buying a new laptop. It's at the point now where all the audio work I'm doing, and even some of the video work. You know, when I was converting the RVD interview for YouTube last week, if you knew what I had to go through, I wanted to throw this thing out the window. This thing started to overheat. It shut down on me. I was like 94% through the conversion. It just shut down. I lost everything. It's time to upgrade to something more powerful that can handle all the stuff I'm doing. And that's going to cost some money, too. I'm not going to skimp and buy a $500 laptop here. I'm going to go the distance and get something powerful that can, you know, support what I'm doing here. And that hopefully will last me for several years. So we'll get it done. We'll get all that stuff done. It's just kind of all hitting at once, which is how these things tend to happen. So again, just bear with me here. I am going to talk about the Bret Hart cancer stuff. It's, you know, awful story this week. But I'm going to save it for the end of the show because I have something else I want to share with everyone. And it's better if I just wait until the end. So that's something you might want to stick around for. Unfortunately, there was other bad news this week. We heard that Axel Rotten, one of the ECW originals from back in the 90s, he died, 44 years old. Pro Wrestling Sheet is reporting that overdose is the suspected cause. This is according to his own mother, who said that he was found in his car outside a McDonald's in Baltimore. Cops told the family it looked like he went into cardiac arrest. Yeah, I know that Axel, I'm not, you know, overly familiar with all of his work and all of his matches. And if you ask me to pick a best Axel Rotten match, you may as well just put a blindfold on me and I'll just pick one at random. I wouldn't know. I know he teamed up with Ian Rotten, with Balls Mahoney, probably, I think, feuded with him too back in the ECW days. WWE brought him in as part of the ECW revival that they did in 2005 when they were building up that first one-night stand show, although I don't think he wrestled on that show. I don't recall him having a match, but I know he was involved, he was there. And then after that, he was wrestling on the indies for many years, I think pretty much up until just the last few years. And last year, he was having some really bad back problems. He was relegated to a wheelchair. He started a GoFundMe campaign to help pay for some operation that would help get him out of the wheelchair. Chris Jericho is very vocal about it on Twitter. I think he donated like $2,500 to the campaign and was really trying to help him out. I don't know if he ever reached his goal. I don't know if he ever had the surgery or not. He had a lot of drug issues over the years, as a lot of those guys from the old ECW did. Him maybe more so than others. It was worse. WWE apparently paid to send him to rehab multiple times. And here's a guy who barely even worked for them. I mean, literally, they brought him in to be part of the whole ECW revival in 05, but if he had any matches, it was, you know, maybe he had a match, maybe. I mean, I recall him running in with, like, the chair and just kind of being part of the group, but I don't remember him really doing much. And yet the company paid for, you know, his rehab several times because, you know, the policy is if you ever work for WWE, no matter how many matches you have, no matter what you do, no matter how long you may be there for, you are entitled, based on this policy, to receive treatment in their program at their facility for substance abuse. And so he got whatever help they could provide to him, and I guess it just never worked. It never took. He just couldn't kick it. And in the end, he paid for it, and it's very sad. Batista was in the news this week. There were reports that came out that he met with Vince McMahon and WWE officials at the SmackDown tapings last week in Tampa. I guess he lives in Tampa. He was there visiting. And they said, hey, let's chat. And they proposed to him in that meeting, allegedly, the idea to be a special referee at WrestleMania. I would imagine for the main event, probably for Roman Reigns against Triple H. And Batista said, thank you, no. He basically turned them down. I don't know where they left the meeting. I don't know if Batista is open to doing something at WrestleMania, but just was not enamored with the idea, you know, creatively that they pitched him. You know, in the past, Batista in interviews, he's talked about, I don't want to just do a one-shot, even a match. I'm not interested in coming back and doing one match of WrestleMania. I don't know if that was a knock on anybody like Rock. I don't think it was. But he is interested. If they have a really good creative idea for him, then he's all in. Because he loves wrestling. He loves it. He loves doing house shows. You know, when he came back in 2014, he didn't just come back to do a special match here and a special match there. For those few months, you know, actually, it wasn't even a few. I mean, he was back for a good, you know, whatever it was, 5 months probably before he had to go off and do some movie stuff. You know, and they reformed Evolution and they feuded with The Shield after WrestleMania. Batista was back full time. He was working TV every week. He was doing house shows. So that's, you know, that's what he's most interested in. And I guess WWE just, you know, doesn't have anything for him. And he's very busy. He's going to be filming Guardians of the Galaxy 2 very shortly. So it looks like Batista will not be at WrestleMania unless they can come up for something for him that he can, you know, really sink his teeth into. And I say good for him. Good for him. You know, if you're not interested, he's not just doing it to get a paycheck. I'm sure if he was a special referee, he doesn't have to do much. He can make a shit ton of money in one night and be in the main event of WrestleMania. And he's not interested in that. But speaking of WrestleMania, I wanted to bring this up. I was just thinking about this during the week, and I put it to you guys on Twitter in a poll question. And almost 1,400 of you voted, so thank you for that. You know, Randy Orton is one of the many, many stars on their roster who's still out injured. He had shoulder surgery back in December. He has come out since then, all the reports about him needing neck surgery. He says, no, I don't need neck surgery, which is good. Good for him. So instead of being out for the entire year, Randy Orton could be back at some point in the next couple of months, maybe. I think it's a long shot that he'll be back for WrestleMania. And even if he's cleared to come back, it's, you know, if he's cleared to come back early, it probably would, like, literally be a couple of weeks, you know, before WrestleMania. I mean, what could they possibly plan for him? I don't think they're going to shove him in a meaningless battle royal. So the chances of Randy Orton being at WrestleMania in a match, very slim. But you never know. And so I put the question out there, if Randy Orton healed up quickly from shoulder surgery, didn't need neck surgery, and he came back in March, let's say, if he was back in time for WrestleMania, of these choices, and I wanted to put some more, but they limit you to how many choices you can put. So of these choices, who would you like to see Randy Orton wrestle at WrestleMania in Dallas? And these were the options I gave. The Undertaker, Brock Lesnar, AJ Styles, and Kevin Owens. I was going to put other, but like I said, I didn't have space. So 1,400 of you voted, and these are the results. It was very close between the two people I would think that you would think it would be close between. Not a big shock there. AJ Styles was the winner, 37% of the vote, but very close was Brock Lesnar at 32%, Kevin Owens at 19%, and then The Undertaker bringing it up the rear, 12%. Now, Orton and The Undertaker had a really, really good match at WrestleMania 21. Some people say Orton should have won. You know, I don't say that because I never would have broken the streak, but it was a great match that they had. Could they have the same kind of match now? You know, both guys were a lot older. Undertaker's a lot more beat up. Probably not the same kind of match, but I think Randy Orton is one of those guys that if you put him in there with The Undertaker here at this stage of the game, he probably is one of the few that could really pull like a classic match out of The Undertaker. I mean, The Undertaker looked a lot better against Bray Wyatt last year than he did against Brock Lesnar, probably because he wasn't concussed. But I wouldn't exactly call the match with Bray, you know, a classic match. It was better than expectations, but I wouldn't call it, you know, a very good match or a great match by any means. So, you know, does Undertaker still have that last one great match in him? I think he does, depending on who he's in the ring with, and I think Randy Orton probably is one of the few who could pull it out of him. That being said, it's a match we've already seen before, and Undertaker is, you know, slower and older and pretty beat up, and you could probably do better for Randy Orton. Now, Randy Orton and Kevin Owens, we've seen them have at least one or two matches before on TV, I know that. I think the two of them could go out there and have a really good match. But when I look at Brock and I look at AJ, I see two opponents who are fresh opponents. You know, him and Brock have not wrestled since 2002. And AJ Styles and Randy Orton have never had a match, to my knowledge. Unless, you know, when AJ was doing dark matches in WWE, he did one with Orton, but I don't think he did. So that's the freshest matchup you could possibly do. And that's why, to me, it's not surprising that AJ won with 37%. I probably would have voted the same way. I would love to see AJ Styles in there against Randy Orton. So he would have been my pick. But Brock Lesnar, you know, he would have been my number two pick as well, because I just think, you know, I personally am interested in the freshest match possible. And I think Brock and Orton is interesting, because it's hard for me to see Randy Orton taking German suplex after German suplex after German suplex. I mean, the guy, he's a great wrestler, but it's like he's made of glass almost. I feel like he's had two collarbone breaks before. I don't know that Brock is the best opponent for him, you know, for Orton's style. But I think Orton and AJ, I think the two of them would go together really well. So, anyway, thank you to everybody who voted in the poll. I think we're pretty much in sync here with what we'd like to see. And look, if Orton doesn't make it back for WrestleMania, he may make it back for the pay-per-view in April. He may make it back for the pay-per-view in May. It looks like AJ is feuding with Chris Jericho right now. You know, hopefully he'll come out of that feud a winner. And maybe when Randy Orton comes back, you know, what do you do to freshen up Randy Orton? You put him in a feud with AJ Styles for a few months. I wouldn't mind seeing that. Monday Night Raw last week was live from Birmingham, Alabama. Raw Instapoll on Twitter. Again, roughly 1,400 of you voted. 24% thumbs up, 71% thumbs down. Yeah, it was pretty dull. Not going to lie. I was very busy, preoccupied maybe is the better word, watching the Iowa caucus stuff on CNN. I was far more interested in that. But I did go back. I watched all the stuff that I missed. So let me just run through this here as quickly as I can. I thought Dean Ambrose coming out to confront Brock at the beginning of the show was pretty cool. It's a match that I hadn't thought of as a possibility for WrestleMania. They could certainly go down that road if they wanted to. They could set things up, you know, coming out of Fastlane. We already know Roman Reigns is wrestling for the championship. We're not getting Ambrose and Triple H as much as I would prefer that match. You know, Brock and Dean, if that was something they wanted to do, and I know Bray, okay, fine. But if they wanted to, it doesn't even have to be for the Intercontinental title. It's not like, well, Ambrose is the IC champion, so you can't really do that match. Well, first of all, number one, why not? Why can't you have Brock wrestling for the Intercontinental title? You know, the way John Cena elevated the U.S. title last year, you know, the idea of Brock wrestling Ambrose, and Ambrose is still a pretty, you know, near the top guy, would do a lot, I think, to elevate the IC title. It would be the highest profile Intercontinental title match at WrestleMania since, I don't even know. I'm trying to think back to what was the last truly big Intercontinental Championship match we saw at a WrestleMania. Honestly, it's been so long, I can't even think of what that would be. You're going back to like the teens in the WrestleMania numbers. Maybe that triple threat maybe with Jericho and Angle and Benoit in 2000. I don't know. But it goes back a long way. So that's not the worst idea in the world. But again, you don't have to keep the Intercontinental title on Ambrose if you wanted to do Ambrose and Brock. They got a network special coming up. March 12th, I think it is, up in Toronto. He could drop it there. So there are ways to kind of get around that. But again, they seem pretty locked in on the Lesnar-Bray Wyatt stuff. This was just Ambrose telling Brock, hey, I'm not afraid of you. You know, trying to build some heat between them heading into the triple threat match at the next pay-per-view. We also had the Brock smirk. It's got its own name now. I've christened it the Brock smirk and call it TBS for short. Only Brock can pull this off. So he let Ambrose live. Even though Ambrose was all up in his face and he wasn't backing down, Brock smirked. He let him live. He left all of his limbs intact, at least until the end of the show. Kalisto beat Rusev by countout. Del Rio was on commentary. We're getting another U.S. title match between the two of them at Fastlane. I'm still hoping they revisit the idea of a program with Neville after this pay-per-view is over and build that up for WrestleMania. They both, put it this way, Kalisto, with the little push they're giving him, Neville, as talented as he is, you know, he's been around now for a while. Both of them deserve better than just being dumped out of a meaningless battle royal. I hope they have more than that planned for them. The Usos beat the Social Outcasts in a pretty boring match. The highlight of this was, or low light, was Lillian Garcia mistakenly referring to the Usos as Grammy Award winners instead of Slammy Award winners. And the announcers, i.e. Vince McMahon, mocked her for it for the rest of the night. You know, they just would not shut up about this. It was funny the first time. First I heard it, I'm like, well, did I hear that right? And I immediately looked on my Twitter timeline, figuring, all right, if she fucked up, then everybody will be talking about it. Maybe I'm going crazy. And sure enough, everybody started talking about it. And, you know, the announcers made mention of it, and it was funny at first. But boy, did they know how to beat something to death and just suck the fun right out of it. After a while, I felt bad for her. And Lillian, you know, Lillian is quite botchtastic. I have to say that, you know, when she goes into the Hall of Fame one day, it'll be just one long gag reel with, you know, a couple of her, like, best national anthem performances bookending it at the beginning and the end. But the middle of it is going to be, you know, all the fuck-ups and all the botches over the years and tripping over her heels and mistakenly calling people by the wrong name and the wrong match stipulations. I mean, you can come up with a 15 or 20-minute Botchamania video just for Lillian alone. But after a while here, they were beating up on her so much, it's like, all right, I get the point. Like, enough. The Miz TV segment, I wanted to talk about this. We had AJ Styles in the ring for Miz TV. Miz was unbelievably annoying, which was the whole point. So it accomplished its goal. Miz, I have to say, Miz is quite great at being an arrogant prick, which is why I think this works so well. The crowd popped very big at the end when AJ finally walloped him. You know, every time AJ would try to speak, Miz did the old Piper's Pit deal where he would pull the mic away and keep talking, and he talked about AJ's life growing up, his career. Yeah, I was disappointed he didn't talk about all the great matches that AJ had wrestling in Florida. I still laugh at that. Miz said AJ reminded him of his former protege, Daniel Bryan, who, in case you missed it, it looks like Daniel Bryan has chopped off the long hair and he trimmed the beard. It's about time. It's a good look for him. The first thing I thought, though, I'm not going to lie, when I saw the picture of him with the shorter hair and everything, I looked at that and I said, he's done. That was my first thought. I looked at that and I said, he ain't coming back. So, but he looks good. Miz said he wanted to help mentor Styles like he did Daniel Bryan. Hey, I'm still waiting on the payoff with him and Neville that went nowhere. That great storyline they came up with. So after a while, Miz dropped the phony praise for AJ. He started berating him. He said, the E in WWE is just as important as the W. So I think we all know who scripted this segment. On and on and on and on he went until AJ attacked him and Miz ran off. And then on SmackDown, they had a match. And Styles legitimately broke some of Miz's teeth on a spinning back fist. This was like an Aja Kong spinning back fist here. Nailed him right in the face. And he beat him with the calf killer, which Mauro Ranallo called the calf crusher, which is fine. I heard the interview that Styles did on Talk is Jericho, which is very good. You should check it out if you didn't. He talks about, you know, what went into planning and making his Rumble debut and hiding him out and all that kind of stuff. And he talked about the calf crusher or the calf killer, and even on that show, which I would imagine was taped a couple of weeks ago, Styles said it's probably going to be the calf crusher or the calf slicer. So I guess of the two, calf crusher kind of rolls off the tongue better. To me, this is not—it's not a big deal. It's still a cool name, you know. Calf killer, not PG. So whatever, it is what it is. They're doing, I think, a very effective job of building AJ up so far. You know, so far so good. You look at Justin Gabriel, okay, PJ Black, who made his debut this week on Lucha Underground. He wrestled his first match on that show against Willie Mack, and Mack beat him. Very first match, and he lost. I don't hear a peep from anybody complaining about that. Can you imagine the uproar if in his first match on Raw they had AJ Styles lose to Chris Jericho in that match that they had? Now, it would have been stupid. Don't get me wrong, I wouldn't have beaten him in his first match. But I just mentioned that because it would have been very easy for WWE to do that. You know, it would have been very easy for them to say, hey, this is the new guy. He has to be humbled. He's in there with a six-time world champion. Jericho goes over. But they didn't. And in fact, AJ Styles has won every single match they put him in so far. It's only been a few weeks, but he's undefeated so far. And he went almost half an hour in that Royal Rumble match. They didn't dump him out after, 3 minutes like a jabron. He didn't go the distance, but he lasted a long time in that match. He had a pretty impressive performance. So I would say so far so good. He and Jericho are going to have a rematch on SmackDown this week. They may end up having another one at Fastlane. I would imagine they would. Can they drag this out until WrestleMania? I think if Jericho turns, or even if it's a slow burn type of thing, but if Jericho really starts to kind of work the evil shtick into his whole deal, almost like 2008 Jericho, I think that would make things more interesting. You can only do so many babyface versus babyface matches before it gets tiring. But Jericho, I think, is the perfect guy right now for him to work with. He's a big enough name still after all these years that it's not like I wouldn't want to see AJ feuding with The Miz going into WrestleMania. If they have a match on SmackDown, okay, so be it. He knocked his fucking teeth out of his mouth. Great. But I don't want to see him feuding with Miz. I don't want to see a long-term feud with Miz going into WrestleMania, because once they do that, look at Neville, right? It's like they're slotting you in a certain position. AJ Styles should not be slotted that low on the card. Not when you have John Cena and Randy Orton and Daniel Bryan and Cesaro and Sting and Seth Rollins and all of these guys out hurt. You've got to take a guy like AJ Styles, and who has some name value, and fucking do something with him. And I think Jericho's a big enough name where it feels like a big deal. So I would keep this going as long as I can. I don't know if they can get 6 months out of it like Jericho and Shawn Michaels did in 2008. I don't think it has to go on that long. But the good thing about Jericho, and why it's also great for him to work with AJ, it doesn't matter if Jericho wins or if Jericho loses, especially if he loses. It doesn't hurt Jericho. But you know either way, the two of them are going to have great matches. Brie Mode pinned Charlotte, turning a figure four or figure eight attempt into a small package after Ric Flair jumped up on the apron, tried to distract Brie, but it backfired, so it looks like they're teasing a split between Ric and Charlotte. It's not the first time that Ric has caused a distraction. And look, I never thought that this was meant to be a permanent thing. We're going to have Ric Flair as her permanent manager. She doesn't need his help anymore anyway. I think he served his purpose, which was to help get her over and get her established as a heel, and I think they've done a very good job of that. Charlotte is much better in that role than she was, with whatever she was doing before. And Brie pinning her here sets up a match, I would guess, for Fastlane, which tells me that the WrestleMania match is probably going to be a triple threat. It's not going to be a singles match. It's going to be Charlotte, Sasha, and Becky. And Becky deserves to be in there. So I hope they include her. I hope that is the match. And Brie is just a way to fill time. I saw that the Big Show was coming up next against Eric Rowan, and I just turned the channel. I just couldn't do it. I had negative, not even zero interest. I have negative interest in watching that match. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. So after the fact, I went back to read what happened, and apparently Big Show beat him with a chokeslam, and then the Wyatts laid him out, and who gives a shit? We had Titus O'Neil against Tyler Breeze, and let me tell you something. Boy, are we on a roll here at this point in the show with these two matches back-to-back. These last two segments here, this is where it becomes very obvious that this show is way too long. They actually gave Tyler Breeze an entrance for a change, and then Titus turned right around and beat him in 2 minutes. It's nice to see them building up. And by the way, Tyler Breeze is Fandango 2.0. It's very obvious that that's all he's going to be. Fandango, look, he still has a job. Some people don't even realize this. He is still employed, believe it or not. So I'm thinking that Tyler Breeze, at some point when Fandango goes away, he'll kind of be in the Fandango role where we probably rarely see him on TV. And when they need him to, trot him out there and job him out to somebody, that's what they'll do. Because they're just a bunch of blind morons and they don't know what they have in the guy. And so, unfortunately, it's just wasted talent. Now, with Titus, you know, they seem to be building him up for something. His matches don't do anything for me. I don't see anything special about Titus O'Neil in the ring when he wrestles. But he's got a lot of personality. He's got a lot of charisma. He's a great ambassador for the company. He seems like a fun dude to be around. If they can tap into his personality even more, somehow find a way to feature that in vignettes or whatever. I still think the only reason he's even getting this push in the first place is because Cesaro got hurt. Otherwise, he'd be tagging with Darren Young. They'd still be doing the primetime players thing. I think Cesaro got hurt, and so what they did was they slid Titus into the feud with Stardust, because that's kind of what they were going toward next for Cesaro. Stardust would be in the crowd watching his matches, flanked by the Ascension, and it was going in that direction. And then he hurt the shoulder, and they just, you know, slid Titus in there like a puzzle piece. Well, we lost this one, so let's plug this one in there. And it didn't really fit. That puzzle piece didn't fit, so the Stardust thing pretty much got dropped. And now they're putting Titus on TV every week in singles matches, and he's winning, and he's winning, and he's winning. And hey, it's good to see somebody kind of new winning for a change. I mean, I know Titus is not brand new. He's been around for a little while, but in terms of getting a big singles push, this is the first time he's really getting one. So that's good. Now, where he goes from here, I have no idea. Right now, you got the two secondary titles, the IC and the US, are held by babyfaces. So I have no idea how far they plan to take this, or how far he can really go with, you know, his in-ring ability, but we'll see. They're trying, at least, with somebody, so you can't really complain about that. Dolph Ziggler pinned Kevin Owens with a zigzag, and the people in my Twitter replies lost their shit. You would think that they did to Kevin Owens here what they did to Dolph Ziggler many years ago, and literally bury him in a pile of shit dropped from the ceiling. Owens has won, what, pretty much every single one of the 50 matches it feels like they've had so far? Dolph had to win one at some point, right? It's just the law of averages. And if they want to do this match again at Fastlane, it's pretty hard to get people excited about it if only one guy keeps winning over and over and over and over and over again. So, Dolph Ziggler won a match. Okay, fine. Not a big deal. Part of the reason, I think, for me, and I'm speaking for myself on this, why I don't have a problem with this, and I don't think it's that big of a deal, I just find it very hard to care anymore about Dolph Ziggler. You know, they've broken me. I really just don't care. And to me, Ziggler is like Brie Bella. He's a placeholder. He's something for Kevin Owens to do until they move on to whatever Owens is going to be doing for WrestleMania, which I'm holding out hope might still be Sami Zayn, because I really don't see a better option for him at this point in Mania. While I'm on the subject of Kevin Owens losing, this is a good time to bring this up here. I have a little note here to bring it up. He also lost to Kalisto on SmackDown. Ziggler was out there, he distracted him, and he lost. I saw an exchange on Twitter. I saw the exchange that everybody, it's been circulating between a fan, very upset that Kevin Owens lost again. He said the company is so short on strong heels, he's asking the Road Dogg. He tweeted the Road Dogg. He's like, hey man, what are you guys doing? Okay, because Road Dogg works for WWE, and not only is he an agent, but reportedly he works in a creative role. He's pretty high up creatively in the totem pole on SmackDown. And Road Dogg responded to this guy, as he does to lots of people on Twitter, which I respect about him, because he doesn't have to answer anybody's questions, but usually he goes tit for tat with them, and he's very respectful, so I respect that. He puts himself out there, but in this instance, he says, wins and losses don't count. It's about character, and he, as in Kevin Owens, is a winner. Now, he's not wrong that character is very important. Certain guys can overcome losing if they have a lot of charisma or if they have a lot of personality. And I think Kevin Owens will be just fine. But I don't think the Road Dogg honestly believes that. I think he's full of crap. And let me say this. If he does believe that wins and losses don't matter, I think that speaks volumes. If this guy is doing creative for WWE, even if it's just on SmackDown, I think it speaks volumes about why things are the way they are in that company. If that is kind of the mentality in that company, if that's the creative mentality, if that's the mentality from the top, I think that says it all. That really says it all. When you look at the lay of the land right now, and the roster of mid-carders that they have, I mean, there it is. But I don't think he honestly believes that. I mean, if that were the case, if wins and losses truly do not matter, why do Roman Reigns and John Cena have to win so often? I mean, ask yourself, that's a very simple question. Why do they win so much more than everybody else, it seems, if it doesn't matter? Well, there is an answer for that. It's because it makes them credible. Not a lot of people on that roster right now that have a lot of credibility. You don't look at that guy, that guy's a winner. Very few people. Brock probably would fall into that category. Roman Reigns would fall into that category. John Cena would fall into that category. And that's pretty much where it ends. There's a reason why those two are the biggest names in the entire company. They don't win the vast majority of their matches by accident. Character is very important. But that's the difference between having a Santino, who had a very nice career for himself. I would have taken Santino's career and made the money he made. Shit. Make people laugh, go out there, make a fool out of yourself, make six figures. Where can I sign up for that job? Santino had a great run, but that's the difference between a Santino, who, as entertaining as he was, not a single person could take him seriously as a world champion, which is where you really make the big money when you're in the pay-per-view main events and all that kind of stuff. Okay, someone like Santino and someone like Kevin Owens or Rusev. When they kept him undefeated, he had that run with the U.S. Championship. I mean, the man was unstoppable. He ended up in a WrestleMania match against John Cena. Why? Because he had credibility. Nobody could beat him. He never lost. And then he lost, and he lost again, and he lost again, and soon he found himself in a fucking love triangle with Lana and Dolph Ziggler. There is absolutely no way that if back in the Attitude Era, okay, let's go back to 1998, as hot as the New Age Outlaws were, if they suddenly started losing every single one of their matches, they lose a match in week one on Raw, okay, and then they lose in week two, they lose in week three, they even lose a fourth straight match. You cannot tell me that Road Dogg would not have at some point gone to Vince Russo or Ed Ferrara or Vince McMahon himself or Triple H if he had the ear of Vince or whoever and said, hey, what's going on here? We're over as fuck and we're losing every single week. Did we piss somebody off? Are we in the doghouse? Do we have heat? What's going on here? Of course he would. So I don't think for a second that he truly believes that wins and losses don't matter. If he is helping out creatively or writing or whatever, then he's got to go along with the company's philosophy. And the company's philosophy is that wins and losses don't matter unless your name is Roman Reigns or John Cena. And I just wish, you know, that he would admit that. If he's going to talk like that, then at least admit that, yes, wins and losses don't matter if your name is Roman Reigns or John Cena. Because I think that's a very important qualifier to put in there. We got a very nice tribute to Mark Henry in honor of Black History Month. That's the video. It was a great video. That's the video they'll play for him when he goes into the Hall of Fame. You know, just do the right thing at Mania. Have him win the Andre Battle Royal like I pitched a few weeks ago. You know, just one last moment of glory for the guy in his home state, in a match named for his favorite wrestler growing up. It doesn't matter who wins this Battle Royal, so just give him the nice moment. It's almost too perfect the way that it's set up here, especially if he is calling it quits after Mania. So I'm still, you know, I got my fingers crossed here that they'll do that. Sasha Banks got some mic time on the show. She is getting out on her own, finally. And Naomi and Tamina came out. They objected to this. They stayed out there for Sasha's match with Becky, which really was not even a match. It was more of an angle. Team Bad ended up beating down Sasha. Becky came to her rescue. Thank God we're finally done with all the stupid teams. Okay, remember when this Divas Revolution nonsense started all those months ago? We had Team Bella and Team Bad and Team PCB and Team PCP and Team OCD and Team OMG. You know, PCB at least ended pretty quick. Team Bella died once Nikki got hurt. And now we're finally rid of Team Bad. That's a plus in my book. We got a segment with R-Truth walking into the men's room. Why the hell there's a camera following him into the men's room, I have no idea. I knew that was against the law, but I guess in the WWE universe here, they have their own laws. Like, you could attempt to murder somebody, for example, and not get locked up. I wish it was actually illegal in their universe here, because he swung the door open to one of the bathroom stalls, and there is Goldust standing on top of the toilet, barefoot, and squatting. And that may be the most disgusting thing I've ever described in my 8 years of doing this podcast. At least until I decide to review the Tammy Sitch video. And by the way, I'm not doing that. That was just a joke. Wrestling Soup did a fine job of that last week. There aren't enough Junkyard Dog books on fucking Audible for you to buy that would convince me to do that. Goldust still wants to team up with Truth as Golden Truth, and R-Truth wants no part of it. Guarantee you, if this were the Attitude Era, this would have involved Goldust coming up to Truth in the shower with some kind of Golden Shower reference. I guarantee it. The New Day came out for the main event. They said they love children. They pointed to a kid in the front row who was doing the New Day booty dance, and the kid happened to be wearing a Bullet Club shirt. I mean, it was right there. I think the father was, too, right next to him. It was right there. They didn't pull the camera off him or anything. Bullet Club got more TV time on this show than Damian Sandow. So we then had Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose against Kofi Kingston and Big E. Superman punch to Kofi. Dirty Deeds to Big E for the win. Brock Lesnar's music hits. He comes out. New Day attacks Reigns and Ambrose from behind with all their attention diverted to Brock. So Reigns, somewhere in here, Roman Reigns got taken out, I don't remember how, and that left Ambrose in the ring all by himself to be F5'd by Brock Lesnar, and that is how they went off the air. And coming out of this ending, I was left thinking, I am far more intrigued by Brock Lesnar and Dean Ambrose than I am anything involving the Wyatts, or Roman Reigns, for that matter.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Finn Balor was injured Friday night at the NXT show in Nashville. WWE.com posted an article about it with quotes from Dr. Amon that he will be undergoing further evaluation on Monday. He left the building on crutches after his match. Then he tweeted a picture of himself on crutches in front of an ambulance, smiling. Hopefully it's just a bad sprain. I saw somewhere it may be a high ankle sprain. Hopefully that's all it is. I mean, they have most, if not all, of their TV, I think, taped through the TakeOver show in Dallas. So hopefully he can just sit out until then and be okay for the show. Bayley came out and did Balor's entrance at the NXT show in Indianapolis last night. He was there on crutches. He took a pratfall, so he can't be that badly hurt if they would let him do that. Little fantasy booking, though. Let's say they had to strip him of the championship. Let's say that he has the evaluation on Monday and they find out that there's a fracture or there's something far worse in there and he's going to be out for a while if they had to strip him of the title. And this will be a little bit of a spoiler for the Dallas card if you don't want to know anything. So all you sensitive folks out there, cover your ears. I just say add Samoa Joe to the match with Sami Zayn and Nakamura. Make it a triple threat and crown a new champion. It's very simple. You know, Sami Zayn is a former NXT champion. He's the one who ends up losing to Joe soon in that number one contenders match, which makes him number three, I guess, in the pecking order. If number one goes down, that means number three moves up to number two. And as far as Nakamura, you know, Nakamura is Naka-fucking-mora. You don't need any more explanation than that to put him in the championship matches first night in. So, boom, there you go. Enzo and Kaz, by the way, with Carmella, they worked the WWE house show in San Jose last night, so they're starting to make some main roster appearances. I was reading one report that said they were super over in the building, all the fans knew all their catchphrases, so I would think a call-up is probably not too far off. NXT also did some house cleaning this week. They released five different people, two of them I never even heard of before. The other three were Bull Dempsey, Marcus Louis, and Sylvester Lefort. I was very bummed to hear about Bull. I liked the guy. I said after they started embarrassing him with the junk food stuff on TV that it would end up getting him over huge as a babyface, and it did. And then they did the Bull Fit thing, and they just sort of lost interest in the guy. And maybe I'm a little partial. You know, he's a Brooklyn guy. But he's already got himself booked on an indie show in New Jersey next month. Sylvester Lefort, he posted a very nice, very humble parting message on his Twitter page. I'm thinking maybe they had to clear some space to pay Nakamura. Not for nothing. I mean, I'm only half joking when I say that. That could very well be what happened here. Yeah, they have a lot of talent. Even Austin Aries, they're bringing these guys in. I don't know what Aries is making. I would imagine Nakamura's not coming over here for fucking peanuts. So when you do stuff like that, you kind of make some room, make some space for the new guys, and that means you got to clear out some of the old guys that you're not doing anything with, and so maybe that's what happened here. Because it's been a while since we've heard of this. I mean, I wouldn't call this like a mass firing. It was, you know, five guys is a decent number. It's been a while since we've heard of them cleaning house like this. So I'm thinking maybe that had something to do with it. NXT this week, it opened with the Vaudevillains beating the Hype Bros with the Whirling Dervish. Vaudevillains appear to be bad guys again. Evil. Or at least that's the direction they're moving back in. Tom Phillips did a sit-down interview with Carmella, and for the first time they acknowledged that she is a second-generation wrestler. Her father was a job guy in the early 90s in WWF. They even showed a picture of him. Paul Van Dale was his name. He's no Iron Mike Sharp. She talked about beating Emma tonight and then challenging Bayley for the NXT Women's Championship next week. She did beat Emma. They had their match. She won with a backslide. Not exactly the strongest way to head into your big championship match, just barely beating your opponent with a backslide, but, you know, a win is a win. Kaz and Enzo then won with a quick squash with the rocket launcher. William Regal announced that to settle the controversy from the end of last week's show about who the number one contender is for the NXT title, in 2 weeks, we are getting a rematch between Sami Zayn and Samoa Joe. And Baron Corbin, actually before he made the announcement, Baron Corbin barged into the room and said, I hope that I'm part of this announcement you're going to be making. And Regal basically told him to fuck off. And Corbin stared him down like he was an ROH or a Dragon Gate guy. Asuka tapped out Santana Garrett with the Asuka Lock. She used a rolling armbar before that. Garrett got out of it, and that's when Asuka turned it into the Asuka Lock, from which there is no escape. I think Asuka, it's safe to say now that Asuka is my favorite performer to watch in any company right now. She is my absolute number one favorite. Main event was Finn Balor against Apollo Crews in what they referred to as a title-free match. Not a non-title match. Title-free. Is that supposed to be like fat-free? I don't think that really works very well as a selling point. Especially when you did a survey a few months ago. And I think overwhelmingly people voted they wanted to see more championship matches on TV, not less. I like their match better that they had on TV a few months ago. At least here we got a decisive winner. That one was the screwjob finish where Baron Corbin ran in. In this one, Balor kicked out of Apollo's standing moonsault into the pin attempt. Hit the sling blade, dropkick in the corner. Coup de grace off the top rope, which is the move that injured his ankle at the house show the other night. I don't know if that means he may need to find a different move, because at some point, you know, you're jumping high in the air and you're landing on your feet in every match. You're probably just asking for trouble, whether it's the knee or the ankle or the foot. But he hit the coup de grace, and then the Bloody Sunday brainbuster for the pin. A decisive win for the NXT champion and a handshake between the two of them after the match. No idea where Apollo Crews goes from here. I think I saw that he may be wrestling the Drifter at the next TakeOver show. It's like fucking Ahmed Johnson against Jeff Jarrett now all over again. And actually, that's not fair to Apollo Crews. If Ahmed Johnson had Apollo's talent back in 1996, he'd have been the world champion. And if I could have understood at least 30% of what he said during his promos, which I never could. So next week, it's Bayley and Carmella from the University of Central Florida campus. That was one of the shows that I attended. I think they taped like three of them while I was there, maybe four. It's hard to tell. All I'll say is that it was the best Carmella has ever looked in the ring, so I'm curious to see if that translates the same way on TV. Quick TNA note, they did release Awesome Kong this week after the incident in the UK with Matt Hardy's wife. You know, it really was the right move to make. It's one thing to go after somebody. I mean, tons of people have gotten into brawls and fights backstage before, but to go after them with their kid, like a baby nearby, that's just stupid. And when you do stupid shit, you know, you're going to get punished for it. And so that's what happened. And people, I had a few people ask me, well, should she go back to WWE and be Karma? I think that ship has sailed. I mean, I think she's got a bad back. And with her history, I mean, this is not the first incident, you know, behind the scenes, supposedly, that she's been involved in. And you have to remember something also. When Karma debuted in WWE, I believe it was 2011. I could be off by a year, but it was around then. It was like 2011, 2012, when she debuted. The women's division, the divas division, whatever you want to call it, it looked very different than it does now. You had Michelle McCool and you had Layla. And I'm not knocking these women, but you had a very different level of talent when it came to the women's division at that time. And also, again, she was younger, she was probably healthier, and so her coming in was a big asset to the division, and it sucks what happened, because it was a real missed opportunity for her to become just this wrecking machine. And she never did reach her full potential there. But now, 3 years later, 4 years later, that division looks very different. And you have a lot of very talented women who can easily carry the load. You've got a lot of other talented women down in NXT who are going to get called up. You know, hopefully Asuka at some point gets the call up. But that, I would imagine, if it ever happens, that won't be for a while. The point is, they don't need her. It's not a case where, boy, you know, we really need this woman to come in now. I would look at her and say there's a lot of baggage there. She's not 100% physically. You know what? I'm not touching this one. So I don't think they need her, and I don't see it happening anyway. Lucha Underground. This was episode 2 here for the second season. Opened with Johnny Mundo against Killshot. I'm a big fan of Killshot. I don't even know why. I just like the guy. Mundo did absolutely destroy him. He killed him with a spear on the outside early in the match. And I saw this, and it really drove home how weak, by comparison, Roman Reigns' spear looks. This was a spear right here. Mundo won with the end of the world, end of days, whatever he's calling it now. He cut a promo afterward on Mil Muertes, broken arm and all, sitting up on his throne. It's such a cool visual having him in the background up there. He looks like Shang Tsung from Mortal Kombat sitting up there. Cage comes out, first time we've seen him this season. He's sporting a new mohawk after he lost a hair match in AAA a few months ago. Actually, I think it might have been against Alberto Del Rio. So he comes down to the ring to confront Johnny Mundo, and they kind of brawl for a little bit, and Mundo scurries away. Marty the Moth still has Sexy Star tied up somewhere. He brings her a dead butterfly as a gift, which freaks her the fuck out. Tells her that his sister says it's almost time for Sexy to return to the temple. And he says, I'm coming with you. We then get an introductory vignette for the Darewolf, PJ Black, the former Justin Gabriel, who got fed up with WWE not having anything for him to do, and famously walked out of a Raw taping without telling anyone. It's funny, too, because he's about to get on the plane home, and he gets a call from Talent Relations saying, hey, where are you? We need you for this segment. It's like, I ain't there, dude. So anyway, he's here riding a motorcycle down the road, and then he gets surrounded by a couple of other biker dudes outside a motel somewhere, and he kicks their asses. So they say the Darewolf is up next. He takes on Willie Mack. And in this match, PJ Black, he did Sami Zayn's Blue Thunderbomb to the Mack, which is impressive because Mack is a big boy. So he did that. They called it Black to the Future, which is so corny. But any kind of Back to the Future reference, you win points with me. You win points with me for that. I heard that, and I was thinking about this, and all I want now is for Scott Dawson on NXT, because he's the only other Scott in wrestling right now that I could think of other than Scott Armstrong. I want Scott Dawson to come up with his own move and call it Great Scott. I would pop huge if he did that. Willie Mack won with the stunner, which surprised me, but I'm trying to think back if they've done that before, where a new guy comes in his first night in his first match and he gets beat, and the first name that popped in my head was Jack Evans. I'm pretty sure Jack Evans also got beat in his first match. So, you know, whatever. It is what it is. We got another vignette introducing us to a new character, this time a female, calling herself Cobra Moon. Cobra with a K, because that's how all the cool kids do it, I guess. It's like China with a Y. So she debuts next week. Main event was the Disciples of Death handicap match against Prince Puma and Pentagon Jr. Matt Stryker made reference to Conan on commentary, made it sound like he is gone for good, which is too bad. I thought he played his role very well. It's kind of like Zeb Coulter. You know, like, I like Zeb. I wish there was still a place for him on TV, but what do you do with him at this point? You know, you just put him back with Jack Swagger? You could kind of go back to that whole thing? It's not even like Swagger's on TV anyway. You're going to fly Zeb around? Does Swagger really need a fucking manager if he's never on TV? I mean, I actually think a guy like Zeb Coulter could be an asset to them creatively, with his background, you know, all the booking and, you know, contributions he's made in that respect. And he did that in TNA too. He's got a pretty solid background in that. I think there's something there for him to offer. It's just not on TV anymore. This was kind of a dead match, I'm not going to lie. It just didn't really do much for me. Puma hit the 630 off the top. Pentagon, who had made the blind tag, snuck in and stole the pin. After the match, the two partners, they came face-to-face. Puma went to go turn away. Pentagon hit him with the backstabber, goes to break his arm. Takes too long. He's looking over at Vampiro sitting at the announce desk. And by the way, they're doing a story every time Stryker on commentary brings up the relationship between Vampiro and Pentagon from last season. You know, for Vampiro, it brings up bad, violent memories. And he tells Stryker, don't do that, dude. Don't bring any of that stuff up. You know I'm on meds. Don't bring it up. So while Pentagon's looking over at Vampiro, Puma manages to escape. He avoids having his arm broken. Here's what I think, and I could be completely wrong about this, but I think what may have happened here is that they couldn't find a second announcer to replace Vampiro for the second season, because I think if they could get like Michael Chavello, who did the Ultima Lucha finale, and I thought Chavello did a great job, but I think he wasn't available to come back full-time to be an announcer. If they could have gotten their hands on a Mike Chavello or a Jim Ross to team up with Stryker, they would have jumped at the opportunity, but they couldn't do it. They couldn't make it work. And so they had to come up with this storyline as a way to explain bringing Vamp back to the booth and acting like almost none of that stuff from last season ever happened. So, okay, let's put him in a mental asylum, and now he's on meds, and now he's behaving himself. That's my thought. Like, I look at this, and that's what I think. So the final scene is Dragon Azteca Jr. wearing the mask of his late father, Dragon Azteca, who we saw Black Lotus kill in the finale last year. I still say it was Matanza who killed her parents, but Dario Cueto convinced her otherwise, and so she killed this poor bastard. We hear a familiar voice talking to Dragon Azteca Jr., asking him if he's ready to wear the mask. And then the person comes out of the shadows, and we see that it's Rey Mysterio, finally making his debut appearance on Lucha Underground. So that's two debuts on the show this week, two ex-WWE guys, Rey Mysterio and PJ Black, and they move some stories forward. We got a preview of a new character that's going to debut next week. Not their most exciting episode, but I give this a thumbs up. It was a solid show. Part of it is they only have 30 episodes, right? This year, or 29, whatever it is. They have no choice but to keep things moving. So they have time to tell all the stories they need to tell. They can't just fuck around and have one week where nothing really ever happens. That and the fact that the show is only an hour long. There's really no dead time on these shows. You know, there could be dead matches. Like, I wasn't enamored with the main event this week, but everything serves a purpose. You never watch anything on this show and say, damn, that was a waste of time. Like, what a waste of time that was. That's one of the best things about Lucha Underground. You hear the announcers sometimes on TV, they talk about a wrestler, like, in a match. This guy, like Randy Orton, I've heard them say this about him. There's no wasted motion with Randy Orton. He has no wasted motion in the ring. That's Lucha Underground. There's no wasted motion with this show. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can always email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Sean from Palo Alto wrote in. He's one of our resident attorneys who listens to the show. He had something to add to the discussion last week about WWE refusing to medically clear Daniel Bryan. I just wanted to read this here because I think it's important. He said, wanted to chime in on the analysis of the Bryan situation. Great job in nailing most of WWE's rationale. What most fans fail to realize is that even if Bryan were to sign a hold harmless agreement, he would still continue to be a liability to the company. Even if Jerry McDevitt produced an ironclad contract, which he no doubt would, Bryan and WWE would only be the only two parties to it. In other words, if Bryan were to have a career-ending neck injury or incur any permanent harm, the hold harmless agreement would not preclude Brie, their kids, or Bryan's family members, depending on his estate plan, from making a claim against WWE. And when a hold harmless is involved, all of those claims would turn into layup settlements because WWE cannot risk those documents becoming public through evidence. Bryan certainly did not do himself any favors admitting his severe concussion history or by continuing to work such a physically demanding ring style. Taken together with all the things you've addressed, I believe WWE feels like Bryan will not scale back in the ring, and the ensuing risks create far too much liability for the company. So that comes from Sean, and I agree with him in that I think a big part of it is the company looks at this guy's ring style, and I don't know that Bryan is going to be able to scale it back. I mean, I don't think he can help himself. The diving headbutt, the missile drop kick where he lands right on the back of his head, the topes out of the ring. You know, he could always try to evolve his style and work more submissions into it and all that, but I think at the end of the day, part of the fear or the belief is that this guy is going to go in there and keep doing the things that he's been doing, and we just can't take that risk. So I think there's a lot of truth to that. On the subject of Brian, we have Myron from Wisconsin. What are your thoughts on the WrestleMania main event proposed by Scott Hall on Twitter of Roman Reigns against Triple H with The Rock in Roman's corner and Shawn Michaels in Triple H's corner with Daniel Bryan as the guest referee? I answered someone about this on Twitter yesterday. I could easily see Rock being in Roman's corner, right? I could see that being the case. Shawn in Triple H's corner is fine. I actually kind of like that more than Vince McMahon even, because I think even the tease of something between Rock and Shawn Michaels, if you can get like one or two in-ring promos or segments leading up to WrestleMania with Rock and HBK, I mean, that's pretty good television right there. That's not something we've seen before, and they can even play off like some of the past heat and whatever. So I'm okay with that. I would, like I said, I would prefer Shawn over Vince if he's going to be out there doing anything physical. But the question is, how do you rationalize Daniel Bryan being the guest referee appointed by the authority? Scott Hall doesn't say. He just says, well, we should have Bryan in there. It makes absolutely no sense. Unless, and this is the only way this would make any sense, and it's not a bad story if they plan to clear Bryan to wrestle again, and there's no indication of that. But it only makes sense if the authority says there's going to be a guest referee for the match at WrestleMania, and they shock the world by announcing not The Rock, not their buddy Shawn Michaels or Steve Austin, they announce Daniel Bryan. And they acknowledge for the first time on TV that Bryan has been out with an injury, he has not been medically cleared, because Bryan himself has gone public with this already. I mean, how many times on Twitter and on Instagram have we seen this guy practically begging the company to clear him? Please clear me, can I wrestle again? You know, please let me wrestle. Many times now he's done this. So it's not like it's some big secret what's been going on. So acknowledge the fact that he's not been cleared and have Triple H make it clear that they would love to see Bryan back in a WWE ring, and maybe he can make that happen, provided that he does what's best for business at WrestleMania. And now what you've done is you've set up what actually is a pretty compelling story of what's more important to Daniel Bryan. Is it more important for him to do the right thing and not screw over Roman Reigns and stick it to the authority after all that they've done to him at the expense of ever wrestling again? Or is it more important for him to get back in the ring and do what he loves to do, you know, to make a living? That's a great story right there. But you can only do that if they've either cleared him already or they know that they're going to clear him and let him come back. If they're not going to clear him, then I think it's a terrible idea, because why draw all of that attention to such a serious situation and the whole concussion thing if you don't have to? Why even bring any of that stuff up? Why get people's hopes up that, hey, Daniel Bryan's coming back. Look, he's back on TV, and then he's not. I mean, you could go through with the same idea that I just proposed anyway. And when Bryan refuses to cheat, or he refuses to be biased and help Triple H win, it makes sense that they wouldn't clear him. And you just use Bryan to raise Roman's arm at the end of the night and sort of endorse him the way that Rock did with John Cena at WrestleMania 29. But if Bryan's not coming back, I think it's better to keep him as far away from that main event as possible. Chris from London, England. I want to make it clear that I am a fan of yours and agree with most of the things you say in your podcast. Uh-oh. I did notice, though, that you seem to be particularly hard on The Rock and what you call his, quote, juvenile crap and his nonsense. Isn't that the same nonsense that has made him one of the most iconic wrestlers of our era? It's his thing, and it's what he does. Have you suddenly outgrown The Rock? I always thought you were a Rock fan, but I guess last week made me realize that you don't talk of him as highly as you do an Austin or even Hogan. Like, when you mention the greats of certain eras, I always notice you mention Austin and skip by The Rock, and I guess that surprises me. With all of Rock's success, do you think of him as being wrestling's greatest ever ambassador? Well, those are two totally different things. As far as the last question, yes, I do. I think Rock is the greatest wrestling ambassador of all time. How can he not be? How can he not be? I mean, how many times do you hear negative shit about the guy? How many times do you hear about him, you know, ODing or something, or, you know, beating up his wife or slapping around his girlfriend, or being a dick to people. All you hear about is what a great guy The Rock is. The Rock could be driving down the street and he sees a fucking cat in a tree and he'll stop his truck and he'll get out and he'll personally pull the fucking tree branches down and he'll rescue the cat. I mean, this guy could do no wrong. And again, I'm not saying that, like, I'm saying that because The Rock seems like a fucking great guy, okay? So, yes, I think he is the greatest ambassador that you could possibly have for pro wrestling. Here's a guy that transitioned from the pro wrestling business to the movie world, and he became one of the biggest movie stars of all time. He did what Hulk Hogan couldn't do, and tons of other guys couldn't do. Steve Austin and Triple H and all these other people that branched out into movies. I mean, Dave Bautista is probably number two. He's doing pretty well for himself. But The Rock is just, he's great. I don't deny that. But I also don't buy into this bullshit. You know, you mentioned you were hard on The Rock and you called it juvenile nonsense. I called some of the insults, some of the words that he used, like llama penises or popcorn farts. Like, I'm not a fan of that stuff. Now, would I have been a fan of that in 1999 if he used that on DX or something? I don't know, maybe. I was in my fucking teens. I would think that there are probably some things that I was more, you know, I found funnier back in 1997 than I do in 2016. So yes, maybe that's the case. I don't think I've outgrown The Rock. I like The Rock. I love the fact that I talked about this segment last week or whenever it was, a 26-minute segment that The Rock did. And I criticized, it was maybe 4 of those minutes. I did say that I thought New Day, you know, got the better of him because I just wasn't a fan of the whole llama penis thing. I think New Day came out and they held their own very well. It's not like Rock buried them beneath the earth or anything like that, like he could easily do with some guys because he's so much better than everybody else on the mic. But again, 26-minute segment, and I criticize a couple of words that he used, and all of a sudden I've become a Rock basher. Like, I'm not a fan of The Rock. Look, when I talk about, people have asked me that Mount Rushmore question so many fucking times. If I never get another Mount Rushmore question, it'll be a day too soon. But I've answered them, and I've talked about it, and I don't remember. I actually don't remember now if I ended up putting Rock on there or not, because I was struggling to come up with enough spaces. I know Austin and Hogan and Cena. I don't remember if I put Rock on there or not, because it's tough. You know, I look at the different eras, and I look at the Attitude Era, and if I had to rank one over the other, I put Austin above Rock. But Rock was a huge star. There's no doubt about it. And Rock carried the company when Austin went down with an injury, and you can't ignore that. And Rock ended up becoming a much bigger, like, celebrity, a much bigger star than Austin was. But in terms of wrestling, when I think of that era and their impact, I think of Stone Cold Steve Austin, because if Stone Cold didn't get over when he did and you didn't have Austin versus McMahon, I don't know that The Rock would have ended up being as successful as he would have, or The Undertaker or Triple H or any of these other guys, because it all came from the success of that angle. It all came from the success of that storyline and Austin getting hot when he did. So that's why I put Austin maybe slightly above him and Hogan too. You know, Hogan, back in 85, 86, there was nobody else on that roster at that time who had the same level of popularity. It was drawing the same money and tickets and everything else that Hogan was. You know, Hogan was a big part of that company becoming as big as it was. I think Vince McMahon owes a lot of his success to Hulk Hogan. Because if Hogan wasn't the right guy at the right time, I don't know, would it have worked if they put Savage in the spot? Would it have worked if Ricky Steamboat was in that spot? You know, probably not. I don't know that Ricky Steamboat would have been on fucking Saturday Night Live with Mr. T. So when I look at a guy like Hogan, who, say what you want to about Hogan, he's had his issues. But, yeah, he's on a certain level. Austin's on a certain level. If Rock is not on that same level, it's just a shade below. That's me bashing The Rock? I mean, come on, dude. Come on. I don't bash The Rock. I've never bashed The Rock. Just because I don't like fucking llama penises. I'm being criticized for not liking llama penises. I mean, for God's sakes. I mean, I just think some of the stuff he comes up with, you know, I don't find some of it funny. And then there's other stuff that I find hilarious. I mean, for the most part, I praised that entire segment. I even said, it just felt different. It felt unscripted. It felt unrehearsed. It felt like they sent him out there. He went overtime. He was interviewing the bozos in the front row. And Vince and Kevin Dunn were probably freaking out in the back. And it's fucking great. I love it. I wish we had more of that on the show. I would love to see Rock on the show every week or every other week doing stuff. So, yeah, because there's certain insults that he uses that I think just sound stupid, I mean, look, people would be bashing me if I didn't criticize that, but I criticized Chris Jericho saying Rudy Tootie Booty, or John Cena coming out and saying, oh, bologna fudge and mustard, which I fucking hate. Remember when he used to do that? You know, if it sounds stupid, I'm going to call him out on it. It doesn't matter if you're The Rock. It doesn't matter if you're Stone Cold Steve Austin. It doesn't matter if you're fucking Zack Ryder. When Rock came out the first time and called John Cena, you know, a big box of Fruity Pebbles, I laughed. Because I looked at John Cena and I said, you know what? He's right. This guy comes out every week with a different color shirt. Blue, red, yellow, green, black, gray, white, pink, purple. It's ridiculous. He does look like a box of Fruity Pebbles. He looks like a walking fucking rainbow. I thought that was funny. I'm sorry if I don't find llama penises funny. But I don't hate The Rock. Stuart from Scotland. What are your thoughts on Kevin Nash managing an NWO stable? As a longtime listener of the show, I know you hate the idea of reviving old gimmicks. But in the current state of WWE, would a power-hungry Nash coming in with a group of NXT stars or disenfranchised WWE guys like Dolph or Ryback taking on the authority work? The biggest drawback I see would be Nash's history of being really poor at scripted promos. I heard that Nash did an interview with Noel Foley, I think it was, and he pitched that idea. I think he was doing it tongue-in-cheek, at least I hope he was, because I don't like the idea. No more NWO, no more Kevin Nash on TV, and I'm not hating on Kevin Nash. I actually just saw he did a kayfabe commentary thing with Sean Oliver. It was mostly like very personal in nature. It wasn't like one of these timelines where they focus on 1 year, which I also think are kind of cool. I did a review, you know, a while back. It's up on our YouTube channel of one that he did with Bret Hart for the year 1992. This was more personal. It was more of a look at Kevin Nash, the man, the family man. I mean, they talked wrestling, but I actually thought it was very insightful, and Nash came off great. You know, he comes off as a very likable, personal, or personable, funny guy, but I just think it's time to move on. You know, I know the paparazzi production stuff with him and the X Division in TNA was pretty entertaining, but it wouldn't be in WWE. They'd have to write everything. Let's write it. And then it would turn to shit. So, no thank you. Logan asks, pretty straightforward question here. In your opinion, how would the Monday Night Wars have changed if Shawn Michaels would have been granted his release when he asked for it and jumped ship to join Hall and Nash in WCW? I think it would have been a blow for WWE losing a guy like Shawn, because Shawn was the best wrestler, I think, in this country, maybe the world. You know, I don't want to speak for Japan. He was one of the best in the world at that point, as much of a dick as he may have been, and whatever problems he may have had. He was the best. There was nobody better in the ring. There was no better performer than Shawn Michaels. So you lose a guy like that, obviously you're going to take a hit. If you're asking me, do I think it would have changed the course of the Monday Night Wars, that WCW would have won? Absolutely not. And I think I've even said before that I don't think if Shawn Michaels... I think Shawn Michaels going over to WCW, if he would have gotten his release, it would have been a disaster. It would have ended up being a complete disaster for Shawn Michaels. It would have been a complete disaster for WCW. Because WCW was the land of the misfits. Okay, the inmates were running the asylum. And a lot of the NWO guys had their own power, and they were playing their own political games at the expense of others. And imagine a guy like Shawn Michaels. This is 1997 Shawn Michaels we're talking about here, okay? Probably at the peak of his problems and whatever the hell was going on in this guy's life. Him coming into WCW with his buddies, it would have been a fucking disaster. It certainly wouldn't have helped WCW beyond maybe initially you get some big matches out of him. But with all the problems he had and the problems he was causing, and what was already going on in WCW and all the egos, I mean, holy shit. You talk about Hogan and Savage, and now you bring in Shawn Michaels, and, you know, let's say Bret Hart now is there, and then they got Bret and Shawn clashing in WCW. Although maybe Montreal never happens and Bret stays, you know, maybe in that respect it changes history. But in terms of the outcome of the Monday Night Wars, I don't think it changes a damn thing. I think WCW still goes down the tubes and Vince McMahon wins. Now, again, maybe in other ways, like Bret Hart not going over there, Bret Hart not getting kicked in the head by Goldberg and then having the stroke, it could have had some big repercussions had things gone down that way. But I think the end result of the Monday Night Wars wouldn't have been any different. Rob from the mean streets of Shelton, Connecticut. I'm going to WrestleMania this year, and this card is looking piss poor. The only match I'm excited for is the potential Sasha vs. Charlotte match. At this stage in his career, Undertaker needs to fight smaller guys. His last great match was with CM Punk at WrestleMania 29. I think he has another great match left in him against a smaller guy. I would rather see the Phenom against the phenomenal one, AJ Styles, or the Demon, Finn Balor. What would you do with Undertaker to help this card out and fill AT&T Stadium? I would have done Undertaker and John Cena, which is what I figure they would have done. We'll see. I still think there's a shot Cena can make it back in time. I agree with your point about Undertaker working well with smaller guys, especially now at the stage of his career. I mean, he couldn't get good matches out of all the big guys he wrestled when he was 25 years younger. Imagine him now in there with a guy like Braun Strowman. You know, I don't know what the story would be for AJ Styles and The Undertaker, and I wouldn't do that match anyway. Undertaker and Daniel Bryan could be a great match. That's not happening. Taker and Rollins. Seth Rollins would be a great match. That's not happening. It's like, man, they're really fucked this year with these injuries. It's like, wow. When you really stop and think about it, it's bad. Demon Balor with their dueling spooky entrances. I like that. The timing just doesn't seem to work. Of course, now Finn is hurt. Hopefully not for that long. I just don't think there's enough time. I mean, how do you set that up, especially when he's already got an NXT title match to build for that same weekend? You know, unless Undertaker challenges him. I mean, that might be an interesting little twist. Change things up a little bit. Usually it's the other way around with somebody calling out The Undertaker. Maybe this time he calls somebody else out, and then you just have to figure out a reason why. Why would he do that? What's his motivation for wanting Balor, who has not done a thing on the main roster, unless they wanted to use Undertaker to put over the NXT roster by challenging their champion to a match and putting him over? You can't bring Balor up in his first match and have him lose to a 50-year-old guy. I mean, I know it's The Undertaker. I just feel like in this instance, maybe in some cases it'd be okay, but in this case, I would not beat Balor. His first big matchup, he loses. But boy, I mean, that would be a hell of an endorsement for the NXT brand if Undertaker challenged him on television and the Demon accepted and the Demon beats him at WrestleMania. That's a hell of an endorsement for the NXT brand. I guess maybe Balor would be a good choice. I would probably agree with you on that. But if that were the idea, I can't really come up with another great pick after him. They really don't have a lot of great options for him this year. Tay from DC, why does wrestling not get enough credit as an actual sport? I've seen many people refer to wrestling as fake, just like the four major sports in this country. We've seen injuries, comeback stories, underdog title wins. If that doesn't scream sport to you, I don't know what does, especially when you take into account the amount of wear and tear guys put on their bodies. Is WWE at fault, or the industry as a whole, for why wrestling is overlooked as a sport? Well, first of all, it depends. You know, some people look at sports as being something with a quote-unquote legitimate outcome. The fact that wrestling has a predetermined outcome in some cases, that automatically disqualifies some people from considering it a sport. If that's your definition of what a sport is, then yes, wrestling is not a sport. If you can look past that, it absolutely is a sport. It's the reason why Tony Schiavone would go on TV every week in WCW and go, you know, this is the greatest night in the history of our sport. You know, it really just depends on your own personal definition for it. But I think you're asking me who's to blame. Who's to blame for why a lot of people don't look at wrestling as a sport? I blame WWE. I blame Vince McMahon. And I'll tell you why. First of all the cartoon nonsense, the way they, you know, book their product, they've gone through periods where it's kind of more serious. Like, I look at the Ruthless Aggression era on SmackDown. There was nothing cartoony about that. I mean, that was some serious stuff they were doing back then with some serious athletes and amateur wrestlers and Haas and Benjamin and Lesnar and Angle and Benoit and Eddie and all those guys. There was nothing cartoon about it. But I think they've gone through these different periods where WWE, they just get so gimmick crazy. You got to have a gimmick. You got to have a character. Let's have a garbage man. Let's have a dentist. Let's have a fucking voodoo guy. Let's have all this stuff. And it's, you know, as a kid, you grow up with these larger-than-life characters, and it's very entertaining. But I could see why a person in their 20s or their 30s or their 50s would look at this and go, this ain't a fucking sport. This is a fucking sideshow. This is a circus. And here's the other reason why. For so many years, WWE ran from the sports label. We're not sport. We're entertainment. We're entertainment. They would go out of their way. They would get angry if they were doing an interview and a media person referred to them as a sport. But yet, in their Did You Know Facts on television every week, they couldn't wait each week to promote the fact that, hey, our new DVD that just came out is number one on the sports charts, right? It's not number one on the entertainment charts. It's number one on the sports charts. They didn't seem to have a problem with that. But for so long, they ran from the sports label. I don't think they're running from it so much now, but they did for so long. How many times has Vince McMahon, he's balked, wrestling's what my father did. It's entertainment. We tell stories. We're movies. You know, we put on 2-hour movies, or now 3-hour movies every Monday night. We're not a sport. Well, why do you think people don't look at wrestling as a sport? Because the people who run wrestling don't look at it as a sport. And so they've created that whole situation for themselves. If I had to put the blame on anybody, yeah, it's Vince McMahon and WWE. They have the loudest voice. He has the biggest company. And as wrestling goes, I think it's fair to say, so goes, or I should say as WWE goes, so goes the rest of the wrestling business. If WWE is in a really hot period, if there was another boom, then guess what? Ring of Honor would benefit. Maybe Lucha Underground and TNA would benefit. PWG, all the indies, everybody benefits. And if WWE goes into the shitter, and some people would say they're already in it now, I wouldn't go that far, but if all of a sudden they go all the way down, they take a big dip in business, that's going to hurt everybody else. That's just how it is. That's how it's always been. Not necessarily in other countries. You can have a dead period in this country, but maybe in Japan or Mexico or wherever, you know, business is booming. I'm talking here in this country. So if WWE is booking themselves to be a joke, if they're booking themselves, we're not sport, we're entertainment, and we have people, you know, fucking other people in caskets and necrophilia and all this other stuff that they've done, then people's perception of wrestling is going to be that it's a freaking sideshow. And that's the way Vince McMahon wanted it. Well, he got what he wanted. Faik from Dubai, I've been listening to your podcast for a while now and have heard you talk about several classic Shane McMahon matches, but have never heard your full thoughts on his King of the Ring 2001 match with Kurt Angle. I thought it was a great match with both men taking some serious bumps. P.S. What do you think are the chances of us seeing Kurt Angle in a WWE ring again? I would say the chances are probably 70-30 that we don't. That's where I would put it. I think that's a match that sometimes gets overlooked. I think there's a lot of praise out there for it, but Kurt Angle and Shane McMahon had one of the best brawls that I've ever seen on a WWE pay-per-view. I'd put it way up there among the best. And I think that's a credit to both guys. It's a credit to Kurt Angle, who was fucking great, of course. And it's a credit to Shane McMahon, who, for a guy that had practically no experience and no real wrestling training to speak of, he went out there. It was a mix, I think, of gutsy and stupid. Some of the bumps and some of the risks he would take and falling 50 feet, you know, when he had the thing with Steve Blackman or the Big Show. And I mean, the bumps he took in that match with Kurt Angle were just sickening. When Kurt tried to give him the belly-to-belly suplex through the glass in the aisleway and it didn't break and Shane just kind of slid down the glass and landed right on his head, you could hear the thud of his head hitting the concrete floor. So what do? They try it again, and the same thing happens. And then he finally throws him through the glass, and he tried it again, by the way. Once he threw him through the glass, they're kind of now behind the glass, like behind, almost like behind the curtain, kind of in a way. And Kurt was going to suplex him through the glass back into the arena, and again it didn't break, and Shane landed on top of his head. And I think Kurt broke his tailbone in the match off a bump. I mean, those guys took a ton of punishment in that match, and the end result was they had a classic match. Like I said, one of the best hardcore matches, brawls, whatever you want to call it, in the history of that company was that match they had at King of the Ring 2001. And you're right, it probably does deserve more attention than it gets. Last two questions here are buy or sells. Kent from Philadelphia. Buy or sell on these dream tag team matches and all the trash-talking promos leading up to them. You must buy one and sell the other two. Hogan and Savage versus Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, 1992. Steve Austin and The Rock versus Brock Lesnar and Bill Goldberg, 2003. Or Bret and Shawn versus Austin and Rock, 1998. Yeah, I looked at this, and I feel like it should have been harder than it was for me, but it took me like 5 seconds to come up with an answer. I'm buying on Shawn and Bret against Austin and Rock in 98. So again, my understanding of the question is, the teams that you're talking about both teams, we're talking about them from that year. So if we're talking about Sean and Brett as they were in 1998, Austin Rock as they were in 1998, let's say it's January, okay, because, of course, Sean got hurt in the casket match with Undertaker and his back was all fucked up. But if we had a healthy Shawn Michaels in the first 3 weeks, let's say, of 1998, Brett and Sean having to team up with each other and that whole story of them having to be partners against Austin and Rock, as big as they became that year, I mean, that's a match. I would love to see that match. You kidding me? That to me is a dream tag team match right there. The other matches are also very good, but that's the one I got to buy on. I got to buy on that one. I got to sell the other two. Allie from New Jersey, buy or sell on which was or is better, the McMahon-Helmsley faction or the Authority? Well, again, pretty easy one for me. I'm buying on the McMahon-Helmsley regime, I think they called it. And I'm selling on the Authority. The Authority at its core is not a bad faction. And I think Triple H and Stephanie as performers are much better now than they were back then. Stephanie was new. I mean, she was only on television not even a year when that McMahon-Helmsley stuff started. And she still had I was going to say the female voice. That I don't mean it that way, but yeah, her voice is much deeper now than it used to be, and I'm sure part of that is age and whatever else. And so, as a performer, though, she has come, I mean, it's just light years. She's come light years from where she was in 2000. She is a great on-air character. I'll never knock Stephanie for, like, not being believable or coming across as a real bitch on television who you want to just see somebody finally get their revenge on her. She's great in that role. It's just what they do with her character and how often she's on TV and how often she gets one over on everybody else. And very rarely does somebody get to have a comeback on her. That's the issue I have. The biggest issue I have is that the Authority thing has been going on now. We're coming up on 3 years. If this thing doesn't end at WrestleMania and it goes into the summer, it's going to be 3 years since this Authority nonsense began. That is far too long. Even the NWO had a very short shelf life. When the NWO was still going on in 1999 and NWO 2000, it was done. It was dead. It was beyond its shelf life. And the NWO was a hell of a lot more popular and a hell of a lot more successful than the fucking Authority was. Or is. It is just so stale. It is so beyond at this point. I'm sick of it. At the time, the McMahon-Helmsley regime was kind of unique. I mean, Vince McMahon had his corporation in 98, which was kind of similar. But this was Triple H marrying Steph doing the heel turn. It was all very unique at the time. They're on a power trip. They're running the show. Triple H brings his DX buddies in to be part of the whole faction. Stephanie's now wrestling. She wins the women's title. But then they had that great moment on Raw in the summer when Lita beat her. And Lita won the women's championship. And that's that's a great all-time Raw moment right there. Stephanie would actually get her comeuppance every now and then. She would take bumps and all this other kind of stuff. Triple H also, as much as he was winning, he was also losing. And he went back and forth with The Rock. They traded the belt back and forth a few times. It wasn't like Triple H was immune to getting his ass kicked, getting his comeuppance, Steve Austin going after him when he came back and dropping him in a car and all the other stuff that went on. The love triangle with Triple H and Kurt and Stephanie, great storyline that ended far too early. So there was a lot to like, I think, about the whole McMahon-Helmsley thing, and it wasn't so one-sided. And like I said, it was unique enough at the time, whereas now the Authority, it's kind of a retread of that. It's like the McMahon-Helmsley regime on steroids now with the Authority. And it's been going on for so damn long, I just can't wait for it to end. So I'm buying on the McMahon-Helmsley regime, and I'm selling on the Authority, and I hope this thing comes to an end at WrestleMania. We are counting down the 15 best matches in WCW history, one match per week for 15 weeks leading up to the anniversary of the final Nitro next month. Match number one was War Games from WrestleWar 91. Match number two was Cactus Jack and Max Payne against the Nasty Boys from Spring Stampede 94. Match number three was Goldberg and DDP from Halloween Havoc 98. Match number four was all three Flair Steamboat matches from TV in 89 lumped into one. Match number five was the Owen Hart tribute match on Nitro between Bret Hart and Chris Benoit. Match number six was Goldberg against Raven for the U.S. title on Nitro in 98. And match number seven was Sting against Vader in the King of Cable Tournament Final at Starrcade 1992. And so this leads us to match number 8 of 15 here this week. For from the first ever Super Brawl, May 19, 1991, from the Bayfront Arena in St. Petersburg, Florida. Sting and Lex Luger against the Steiner Brothers for the WCW World Tag Team Championship. Jim Ross and Dusty Rhodes are your announcers here. This was an interesting match because it was a babyface battle, babyfaces against babyfaces, and the Steiners were arguably at their peak here at this point. They were not only the WCW Tag Team Champions, they were also simultaneously the IWGP Tag Team Champions over in Japan. So before this match, before they go live to the arena for the introductions, they play a video package. And WCW had hired somebody new to work on videos for them just prior to this show. So the video here was the work of that person. Very cheesy. I mean, think Rocky, but cheesier. But I have to remind myself, I'm watching a video from 1991 here in 2016. So, you know, that's to be expected. It was just this instrumental music in the background, these very slow clips of Sting and Luger walking around and high-fiving and the Steiners doing suplexes and stuff. So like I said, this was babyface against babyface. Crowd was into this thing all the way through. There was none of this, nobody knows who to cheer for, so let's all be quiet kind of stuff. Like, these people were into everything these guys did. They were loud from start to finish, you know, for the 11 minutes or so that this thing lasted. It wasn't that long. Nonstop action. You know, I talked about Sting and Vader in the King of Cable finals last week. I believe there was a spot in that match where Sting did a plancha out of the ring onto Vader and Harley Race on the floor. Sting did another plancha here, this time onto Rick Steiner. I think if Sting was 30 pounds lighter, he'd have made a hell of a cruiserweight. He had a great exchange later in the match with Scott Steiner that made me want to see a singles match between the two of them. I'm not sure if they ever did that or not. Back in those days, I'm not talking like Big Papa Pump or anything. But it also illustrated to me how freaking talented Scott Steiner was back in those days before he really kind of blew up in size and became Freakzilla. The way he moved around in the ring for a guy as big, and he was big even then. I think that's what kind of bugged me about Scott Steiner. I mean, the guy could do what he wants to, and look, it worked, right? He was one of the big stars during the Monday Night Wars, and he won the world title. He never did when he was Scott Steiner back in the early 90s. But I look at Scott Steiner in the early 90s, even when he went to WWF, he was still a big guy, big muscles, very agile, can move around very quickly, and he could do a standing, you know, the standing Frankensteiner that probably fucked up his neck after all those years. And I just look at that and I think to myself, why, dude? Like, why did you feel the need to go ahead and just completely blow yourself up the way you did? You know, I look at that guy and I say, this guy was just perfect as he was. And as time went on, maybe he would have ended up being a world champion anyway. Maybe he would have broken up from Rick and he would have gone on and had a great singles career and had great matches and could have lasted longer. And I don't know. The Scott Steiner from this period and the Scott Steiner from the late 90s, I was not a big fan of. He was very entertaining, I guess, but two totally different people. I look at this guy here and it's like he's like a whole other person. Sting reversed the tombstone pile driver on Scott late in the match. We got a ref bump. Down comes Nikita Koloff with a chain. He goes to hit Lex Luger, who was the U.S. champion at the time. I don't remember if they were feuding or if this was supposed to be the beginning of a feud and he wanted to go after the U.S. strap. But Secret Service Sting takes a bullet for his partner here. He shoves Luger out of harm's way as Koloff is running down the ramp. This is when they had the ramp that connected the ring to the end of the aisleway. And Koloff comes running down with the chain, and Sting shoves Luger out of the way. Sting takes a shot right to the head with the chain, busts him open. Although you can see the moment when he goes down where he cuts himself. Scott pins Sting, not realizing what just happened. It's a shitty way for a match this good to end, but it's still a great match. Nikita disappears to the back. Tony Schiavone is there waiting to interview him. Sting runs to the back, goes after Koloff. The two of them brawl outside the building, and then they send it back to JR and Dusty at ringside to talk for a little bit. This was a great match. It was not that long, but it had everything that you would look for in a match like this. It had tons of crowd heat, some really good action. It was never boring. It was never dragging, because it really wasn't long enough to drag. I mean, if this were a 20-minute match, I'm sure they would have had a ton of rest holds and all that stuff with guys that, you know, these guys that were this big. But you never really had that in this match, and there were some pretty spectacular moves. And finish aside, I just thought this was great. So your tag team championship match from the very first Super Bowl, which, of course, you can hop on the WWE Network and check it out if you want to. That's match number 8. We'll do match number 9 next week. And I want to transition over now to something a little more somber, which is Bret Hart was in the news this past week. He went on Facebook, and he revealed that he has been diagnosed with prostate cancer. And he didn't give a lot in the way of details about it, you know, exactly when they caught it, if it's super early or if it wasn't early. I think his brother Smith in the last few weeks had just come out and Smith went on some kind of rant, I think, about why Owen Hart would not be inducted in the Hall of Fame. Like, once he found out Owen wasn't going in, he started ranting about WWF. And I think in doing so, he revealed that he was suffering from prostate and, I think, bone cancer, like two different kinds of cancer. So he's in rough shape, too. Bret, hopefully it's something they caught early. He was supposed to have surgery this past week. He didn't mention anything about treatment like radiation or you know, chemo or anything like that. It's a scary thing. You know, I was just at an independent show last night, and I was sitting next to somebody. I'd never met the guy before. Good guy. And we're talking. And he asked me, like, who's your favorite wrestler, like, of all time? And I said to him, if I had to pick one person, it would be Bret Hart. And he kind of lit up, and he said, really, me too. And he kind of lifted his shirt. Like, he had, like, two shirts on. And one of the shirts he was wearing was actually an old Bret Hart shirt. I'm like, holy shit, look at that. So, you know, we hit it off, and we're talking about Bret Hart there for a little bit. And Bret Hart is, if you ask me, you know, who my favorite wrestler is of all time, if I had to name one. I mean, I grew up a Hulkamaniac. You know, who knows if I'd be a wrestling fan if it wasn't for Hogan. So, you know, he'll always have that place in my wrestling fandom. But it's Bret Hart, because Bret, to me, was, you know, he was what a pro wrestler should be. You know, he had great matches. He could take an ass kicking. He made it look real. Everything about Bret in the ring was real. I mean, the ass kicking he would take, he really looked like he was getting his ass kicked. He could sell his ass off in that ring. His punches, you know, we joke about John Cena throwing punches or Kevin Nash throwing forearms and guys that just don't know how to throw a punch, or they throw a punch and it just looks completely silly. But then you have people like Bret Hart and Jerry Lawler and even Steve Austin, I throw him in there, who looked like they were throwing freaking haymakers in the ring. Just everything about him, and even just the presentation and you know, his gear, the way he carried himself, to me, that's a world champion right there. I have a lot of respect for Bret and all the classic matches that he's had. And he's been through a lot of shit in his life, especially from Montreal onward. I mean, there's been a lot of things that he's been through in his life. And, you know, I know he had a cousin or a nephew or something who died of some flesh-eating disease many years ago. This was when he was still in WWF. But, you know, Montreal happened, and it's like, this guy's life, I mean, he got a great money deal with WCW. I'm not crying for him at the time in that respect. But it just seems like everything unraveled after what happened in Montreal. He never fit into WCW. He just, it felt wrong, him being there, and they never did much with him. And then he got kicked in the head, and he had to retire, and he fell off his bike, and he had the stroke. And all of the friends that he made in the business, I mean, he was friends with guys like Rick Rude was a very close friend of his, Crush was a close friend of his, Roddy Piper, Randy Savage, his own brother, obviously, Bulldog. I mean, there's a whole laundry list of people that he's lost. All these friends and colleagues and family members of his that have died. It's just, when you look at what this guy's been through, and it's like, for God's sake, I mean, enough already, you know? So now this, and hopefully everything will be fine. Prostate cancer is one of those things where if they catch it early, usually you get a pretty good outcome with that. I mean, as with any kind of cancer, if you catch it too late, it doesn't matter what it is, that's usually bad news. Every indication, hopefully, it seems to me like a case where they caught this relatively early enough, and I guess we'll find out soon the next time Bret wants to give everybody an update. Obviously, it's a personal thing, but hopefully he'll be fine. There are worse things, worse types of cancer to be diagnosed with, so all the best to Bret Hart, obviously. And when I heard the Bret Hart news, you know, there's been a lot of stories in the news lately about a lot of celebrities and musicians. I mean, all these people that are just, you know, dying almost all at once. It's like you hear celebrity deaths, like they come in threes. I feel like they've come in like sixes and eights now. And a lot of them, you hear, you know, it's all from cancer, and it's terrible. I mean, you just hear so much more now about cancer. Now, I've shared on this show before, and I realized in when I was thinking about this that it's been a while since I've given everybody an update. A lot of you guys still tweet me, or you'll email me, and you'll ask me every now and then, hey, how's your mom doing? Because I've shared, you know, what my family has been through before and what my mother is going through now, where she's sick again. You know, my mother was diagnosed with leukemia 11 years ago. It'll be 12. And she beat it. And then she had breast cancer. And she beat it. And things were quiet. Things were quiet for many, many years, like 5 years. And then last year, you know, I lost my father in the car accident. Right after that, found out that my mother's cancer had come back. It's in her liver now. But, you know, you hear, oh my God, you know, stage four cancer, this can't be happening. Like, how could one person go through so many different things? And she's had skin cancer before. So I think of someone like Brett and all the shit he's been through. I think of my own mother, you know, and what she's been through. And it's just, it's not fair. It's really just, it's not fair. So for the people who have asked, though, for updates, because they haven't really talked much about it since then, she's doing well. And I thank all you guys for asking about that. That's very cool. She's doing well as can be expected. We've been able to avoid, you know, chemo, and which may be an inevitable thing. But in her case, thankfully, she had the option of trying something, a different kind of treatment, like a hormone treatment. So she's doing that. She's on that in tandem with the chemo drug, although it's not something where it's had the same effect on her, like losing her hair and not being able to work and being very, you know, gaunt or anything like that. You would take one look at her and you would never think anything is wrong. And she's working, and she's got her good days and she's got her bad days, and I help out in any way that I can. And all things considered, things are going well. She just had a scan last week. She was having, there was something going on and we were worried. Scan came back. There is evidence of some cancer in the bones, but the doctor doesn't seem to be overly alarmed by it, and it's not as though our fear is that maybe it spread to other places. It didn't. So that was a good report. And, you know, all of these different things are happening. And I actually wasn't even going to say anything, in all honesty, but I don't know. When I heard about Bret Hart, I was thinking about it. I'm like, you know, it's just, I may as well just, I'm going to mention it at some point anyway. It's like, why am I, you know, keeping it a secret? So, and I don't mind sharing things with you guys either, because you guys, look, I got people listening to this show who have been listening since 2007, since like episode one. People who donate their money, who make like weekly PayPal donations to the show. And it's like, it still blows me away when people do that. So in some ways, I know it sounds kind of corny, but it's almost like I have my actual family, and I have like my sound off family. I've used that word even in the Facebook group sometimes. And families can be very dysfunctional, especially the one in the Facebook group. But I do. I look at you guys kind of like that. So I don't know how many of you remember. In December, I posted a tweet. It kind of came off more cryptic maybe than I intended it to. I was actually at one of my mother's checkups with her. I don't go to every single one of them, but this was kind of a big one, and I wanted to be there for it. And so I could ask questions, you know, to the doctor if she, you know, missed one or two. And I happened to met, now, if you remember, I did a show at the beginning of December. I was sick as a dog. I came, I did a podcast. I probably shouldn't have done it. And the next day, I got even sicker, and I'm like, I got to go to the doctor. So I went to the doctor, and the doctor came back to me, and he goes, well, you know, there's some stuff on your blood test that's a little high, but it may just be because you're sick. Come back to me in a month when you're feeling better. We'll test you again. I'm sure it's nothing. Fine. So in that time, I was with her. And I met the doctor, and I know her oncologist. I mean, he saved her life. You know, he's been her doctor now for over a decade. He knows me very well. And I bring this up to him, and I said, you know, I have to, you know, in the next week or so, I'm going to have to go get tested again. He goes, well, I'll just do it here. I said, oh, great. And got those results back, and there was still some stuff that was higher than it should have been. And he said, listen, I want you to go get tested for this. It's like a certain gene mutation. I suspect you may have it, but I don't know. So whoever your doctor is, have them test you for it. Long story short, I did test positive actually for this little mutation. And you know, one thing leads to another because you have to go for all kinds of tests and you don't really know for sure. And then finally, you know, they can kind of give you a sense of what you're dealing with here. And they diagnosed me with kind of a rare type of blood cancer. And I found this out, it's probably been a month now. That was not what I was expecting to hear, obviously. And so now my mind is just racing in a million different directions, and it's, yeah, I don't even know what to say when I first hear that. So I didn't want to say anything at first because I still didn't really know a whole hell of a lot about it. I knew, okay, this is what I have, but like, what is it and what do I do? So that's what my last month has been. I've tried, you would never know it, I think, listening to this podcast, but I have been just, I'm nervous. Just a basket case, as you would imagine. Putting a brave face on it, of course. And I've had to go for some other tests to rule out some other things, and thankfully we were able to rule that out. And yeah, basically what it is, it's like a rare type of blood cancer that I have. It's not curable. It's a chronic progressive thing, is what they call it. It's got a certain name. And, you know, basically my body produces too much blood. It's not something that you're born with. It's something, it's like a switch gets flipped at some point during adulthood and there's like a defect in the bone marrow and all of a sudden your body is producing too many red blood cells or in my case like too many platelets or whatever it may be, and that's not a good thing because what that does is it puts you at risk for blood clots which can lead to stroke or heart attack, and that's kind of the big concern. The good news is at the moment, it's kind of just status quo. I'm not doing anything at the moment. There's really no need. We might have been starting something where they kind of drain a pint of blood out of you at a time. That's apparently one of the typical treatments for something like this is what they call phlebotomy. And you just kind of lay there and they literally stick a needle in your vein and they got to drain a pint of blood out of you because you're producing too much of it. And they want to get your counts down to a certain level. Last I checked, they kind of came down a little bit on their own. They're still high, but we don't have to jump into anything so quickly. You know, there's been talk of some other stuff. I'm not even listening to that. I'm not interested in that. I feel fine. You would never know. Again, you know, I nobody would know anything is wrong if I didn't say anything, and I probably could have just kept my mouth shut, but I don't know. It's kind of hard to keep something like that a secret, you know, especially when it's been weighing on me all these weeks and I've kept my mouth shut. I went to Orlando and I got to say, and I got to thank them here again. I already thanked them in person, but, you know, Noah and Brian and Mike and all those guys in Orlando for the Rumble. That trip was planned months ago. It just happened that way. And it was the best thing for me because it was just a chance for me to go away for a few days and take my mind. First of all, avoid the snowstorm that hit New York, but just take my mind off all of this bullshit. I mean, that trip came for me at the perfect time. And then, of course, I came home and it was right back to reality. So that's kind of where we are right now. I mean, it really shouldn't have any effect on the show, at least not in the foreseeable future. Anything that I may or may not have to do, I'm sure I could work that around the show. I mean, to me, if anything, the show becomes even more important because it's just something to take my mind off all this other nonsense. So, yeah, it was pretty surprising. It was pretty surprising for me to hear that, you know, and that's really what I wanted to get off my chest. Yeah, I feel a little bit better now that I said something about it. And who knows, maybe there's somebody listening to this podcast that, you know, is going through the same thing or knows somebody who is and can you know, shed some more light on it for me, because there's still some questions about exactly like what type it may or may not be. It's one of two things. It's a rare enough thing that you normally don't see this in people until they're like 60. And so it was kind of surprising to them. And, you know, normally if you're in your 60s, you get diagnosed with this, you end up dying of something else or you die of old age. It's a little bit different when you're half that age. There's really not a whole lot of stuff to go on as far as predicting anything. It's like one out of every 200,000 people get this. I'm like, oh, great. Yeah, lucky me. But I look at Bret Hart and I said to myself, you know what? It always could be a lot worse. And that's how you have to look at it. It could always be a lot worse, you know? I can go to the doctor tomorrow and he could tell me you have colon cancer, you have throat cancer, you have brain cancer. I mean, it could always be a lot worse. It's a scary word, and I'm upset, and I'm pissed off, and I'm confused, and I'm all of those things. And I think because of my own experience with my own family, it just feels like piling on more than anything else. You know, it's not been a good couple of years, I guess, in that respect for my family, but you just kind of, you deal with it. It is what it is, and you just kind of go from there. So, anyway, that's my story, and I just wanted everybody to be aware of what's been going on. So, kind of a shitty way to end the show, I know, but it's all good. Again, I feel fine. It's not affecting the show in any way. And so, on from here we go. You can follow me on Twitter. At Solomonster is my handle. As always, don't forget to vote. I'll throw up that Raw poll when the show goes off the air on Monday night. And you can vote thumbs up, thumbs down. Leave some love for the show on iTunes and Stitcher. I don't mention that enough. You cannot just rate us on a 5-star scale. We are a 5-star rated podcast on iTunes. But you can leave a review. And so anybody who may not have heard this show before will read the reviews and will decide if this is the kind of show that might be for them. And if you are a fan, then let people know you are. Let people know what you like about the show. So again, you can leave us some love on iTunes and Stitcher. Don't forget we have a free app in the Google Play Store. You can download that. It's free. Doesn't cost you anything. I just updated some of the screenshots actually online in the Google Play Store. So head on over there and download that. And that's it. We will be back for a brand new podcast next weekend. That'll be episode 425. Be well, stay safe, and we will see you next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
You know what annoyed me more than anything else on this show last Monday night? Instead of just calling it Fastlane, they called it WWE Fastlane.
At WWE Fastlane, I'm going to beat you.
Drove me nuts.
You and I are going to have a match at WWE Fastlane.
All night with this. Who talks like that? If aliens landed on Earth and attempted to engage a member of the WWE roster in a conversation, you know what they would think? Holy shit, these creatures are stupid. And then they would exterminate every last one of us.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007, The Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.